may not recognize that banjo. It's not Michael Miles, my dear friend. It is Steve Wade. Stephen Wade, who is a Chicago-born and bred and who picked up a banjo at the tender age of 13, has a new CD out called Across the Ameriki. Steve made a small fortune creating a show called Banjo Dancing that played forever here and forever in Washington. I'm going to play him all night. It is my great pleasure, because she is doing great things and she is a great person, to have on the telephone my dear friend Barbara Kennan. Barb, how are you?
I'm good, Rick. How are you?
It took a while to get you. I've known Barb for a very long time. I've known her since she worked for the city as the director of, you've had a number of jobs, but director of artist resources. And remember when we kind of almost collaborated on a couple of things? You were in charge of those. What were those things called, Barb? Those sort of stanchions that were placed at various places to remind people of the famous Chicagoans who used to live and or work nearby. What was that thing?
That was the Chicago Tribute Markers of Distinction program.
Oh, I love that thing. I just love that. You were in charge of that. You left the city, but now you are doing something that I think is, with all due respect to what you did before, has the potential to be as important as anything you've ever done. You're the co-founder of something called Creative Chicago Reuse Exchange. When did you, before I even explain what it is, when did you start this? When did this idea come to you to take basically unused artists, all sorts of materials, furniture, paints, everything that were being thrown out, and try to get them to the people who need them, specifically and primarily Chicago public school teachers? When did this idea come to you?
You know, the idea came to me in fits and starts, but really, I was in New York City about 5 or 7 years ago on a work-related trip, and I came across a place called Materials for the Arts, and it was amazing. It was a giant warehouse in Long Island City, and it was filled with stuff that was being collected from all sorts of places, and they were giving it away to teachers and nonprofits, and they would get things from Google and from Martha Stewart and from the Metropolitan Museum, and it would be books or fabric or costumes or, you know, stereo speakers. And I thought, oh my goodness, we need to have something like that in Chicago. And so I came back to Chicago and I was trying to get people at the city interested in it. But, you know,
it's a bureaucracy.
It was a bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's a bureaucracy.
And also, you know, working downtown, you see all kinds of things that people are throwing out there. It's in the alleys or it's in the dumpster or whatever. And I realized, certainly at the Cultural Center, we throw out things all the time after different events. And I realized people were doing that mostly because there wasn't a really easy, organized, streamlined process to donate things that were clean, safe, and working, but you didn't need anymore, and give it to teachers in this case, or to nonprofits who all are operating on really, really small budgets.
You know, I recall in all the crisis, financial and otherwise, facing Chicago public schools, you know, when I was a kid going to public school in Chicago, there was never a question that we would have crayons and paper and we paste and we were able to create stuff. But in recent years, I know a ton, as I'm sure you do, of teachers who have to supply such materials, if they decide to supply them at all, out of their own pocket. True?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it's kind of staggering. We started doing a teacher's material survey, and we started asking teachers, you know, what's your annual budget for supplies? And all the CPS teachers are saying nothing.
Zero.
Except we might get $250 from the teachers union.
Yeah.
How many students do you teach on an average? And it's like 128. Mm-hmm. So we know how far that money's going to go.
Yeah.
And how much do you spend out of pocket? And teachers spend $200, $500, $1,000 a year or more out of pocket on things like Kleenex and batteries and dry erase markers and paper and pencils. So we asked, you know, what do you always need? What do you dream of getting? what do you get donated? And it was fascinating. People dream of getting things like portable fans, hot plates, scooters, laminating material. I mean, tap and ballet shoes, puzzles and games, Legos, rugs.
And this is basically Barb Kennan, the co-creator of Creative Chicago Reuse Exchange, which is starting its donation drive this week. You'll get all the details in this half hour. It is the need, even for someone who is as tied into the city and knows the city and gets around the city as you do, the need, the amount of need is staggering once you started talking to these teachers, right?
It is. But what's really inspiring is that, you know, they're so grateful for pretty much anything they get.
Yeah.
Because they're all on their own. They're operating either independently on their own or within their school, and they have to rely on themselves to kind of be creative in where they find things. So when you say, here's some fabric and here's some gardening tools, it's very exciting because teachers actually, somebody gave us a big box of old medicine bottles that hadn't been used. And teachers had a million ideas of what they would do with those. You know, they look at things that all of us would think of was just trash. And they were like, oh, no, you can make a mosaic. You can use it for, you know, to put beads in. You can do all sorts. You can make musical instruments out of it. So being able to feed the creativity of teachers as well as help them out because they're operating on such slim budgets is really rewarding and satisfying.
Well, see, I think how did you formally and when did you, Barb Kennan, formally create this nonprofit organization called the Creative Chicago Reuse Exchange? When did you, and you're a co-founder, so you have another co-founder. When did you two, and who's the other person, decide, okay, we can actually make this work? And when did you found the nonprofit?
Well, we incorporated last year, and we got our 501c3 designation in March of this year. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty new. And my co-founder is someone who I went to art school with here way back in the day. Carolyn Otmers is a wonderful sculptor as well as a teacher at the School of the Art Institute, and the person who started their foundry and ran their sculpture department for many years. And Carolyn is amazing because she will see materials and have all kinds of ideas what to do. For example, we were out somewhere and we saw a big pile of radiators at like a junk place, right? You know, and she got so excited because she could think of all the things that you would do with a big pile of rusted metal because she runs a foundry. So we're a really good combination because she's unafraid of materials and extraordinarily creative. And I, because I worked for the city for so long in the Department of Cultural Affairs, I know some of the, you know, places that you can ask or, you know, some of the ways that things can hopefully work. And so we're trying to create some momentum behind this idea with, you know, some of the big institutions that CPS, obviously, and the Park District and the city and some other ones who are all, you know, out in the communities and can support an initiative like this.
You know who would be Barb Kennan, who would be so proud of this idea is not that your latest boss was not a good guy, but Lois Weisberg would be losing, the former commissioner of cultural affairs. This is so like a Lois idea. You can be very, very proud, but she would be, wherever she is, beside herself. I'm talking to Barb Kennan for the rest of this half hour. She's the co-founder of the Creative Chicago Reuse Exchange, which is in the business and soon to be in the... I know you've already gotten some donations and you've gotten some teachers very excited, but starting Monday at the new headquarters of the Chicago Teachers Union at 1901 West Carroll Street. It's a handsome building on August Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday from 10 to 4. They'll be dropping off and taking donations from you people and other businesses. It's pairing. The ripple effect of this is going to be astonishing, and we'll continue on with Barb Kennan after a short commercial break. Barb, I love this, would be going nuts, just nuts. You're hearing the latest from Stephen Wade's new album called, yes, I call it an album, Across America. I'm talking with Barbara Kennan, a dear friend of mine, the former director of artist resources for the city of Chicago, the Cultural Center. She, along with Carolyn Otmers, a former art classmate of hers, have founded something called the Creative Chicago Reuse Exchange, which is going to pair people in need of materials, most of them for making and creating art, with those people, whether you're at a company or not, who have no use for some of the things that are used for making art. Is that relatively succinct, Barb?
It is, except for two things.
Yes.
Not just art.
That's
even
right.
Even though we're trying to capture the imagination and instill creativity in with teachers and with students, but it isn't just art. It's also science and math and engineering, and teachers need things like binders and folders. I mean, it's art materials, absolutely, but then other things as well. But yes, succinctly, that is basically what we're doing.
Now, you have already talked. Oh, don't be silly. You've already talked to a number of teachers. I mean, the teachers must be unbelievably excited by this. It must seem like Christmas time to them. Yes.
Well, we're hoping. They are excited, and a lot of them think, oh, yes, of course, this makes so much sense. They're really, really glad that
Well, many
happening.
May be saying this makes so much sense it just can't possibly work for the city of Chicago. But you are having, it is Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at the new headquarters of the Chicago Teachers Union, which they call the CTU Center at 1901 West Carroll Street, Carroll and Damon. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. is a swap circle where you were asking people to come to that place. Are you going to be in the parking lot? Will you be in that beautiful big lobby they have? Where will you guys be taking these donations?
Well, there's a loading dock that's right at 1901 West Carroll, so on the north side of the building.
Mm-hmm.
And Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday is our donation day. So those are the days where we're asking businesses and individuals across Chicago to donate their surplus materials and supplies. And then on Friday and Saturday is when we are inviting the teachers in for what we're calling a swap circle for teachers. So we're going to get everything in, we're going to organize it, we're going to sort it, we're going to set it all out, and then for 2 days we're going to invite teachers to come in. They have to show us their ID or something that shows that they're really a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also are going to have a number of artists and teachers who are going to demonstrate creative reuse projects.
Oh, how wonderful. Yeah.
There's going to be somebody who's going to show all kinds of robotics and electronics projects. And, you know, somebody else who's going to be doing screen printing, book binding, a green curriculum, you know, book that somebody's put together. So there's going to be lots of ways that teachers can be inspired by the different materials and by the different processes and techniques. And it's going to be a really great opportunity for them to talk amongst themselves and to meet each other and to compare notes.
Oh, I think so. Jeez, this is just remarkable. The website for all of this, for this is creativeshirx.org. That's creativeshirx.org. Who have you contacted in the donor realm, Barb? Who do you have who's going to pull up in a big truck and say, look at all this stuff we got for you, use it well?
Well, you know, we've already received a couple donations like that, and then this week is also going to be a mystery. We're going to see what we get. But we've been very grateful to the Lyric Opera, for example, to the Chicago Children's Museum, Dick Blick, and Lake Forest College actually called us up, and they said, we have a bunch of easels and a bunch of drawing chairs that we no longer need. So we got a truck full of those.
How did you get the word out, Barb Kennan, on this? How did you start to get the word out? Just it wasn't cold calling places, but just talking to friends and spreading the word.
Yeah, a lot of it was word of mouth. I reached out to some of the business and professional associations. So we reached out to, the American Institute of Architects and the Graphic Designers and the Building Owners and Managers Association and, professional associations, asking them then to reach out to their members.
Mm-hmm.
The Industrial Council of Near West Chicago, ICNC, has all those incubating small businesses, and some of them have been extraordinarily generous with, giving us T-shirts or doing free printing. And there's an organization in L.A. that does this sort of thing with the film community, and they were doing actually right outside your window in Pioneer Court. There was an event recently that had everything covered in red AstroTurf for a
right.
Target, and we're getting a lot of the stuff from that. So if anybody needs red AstroTurf,
you've got it. Now I know you're starting. I know your initial aim is toward mm-hmm. public school teachers, but this might also it expands and is available to other sorts of nonprofits out there. Yes.
Yes. This event actually is us testing the market, and it's an experiment. So we want to gauge, the enthusiasm of both the donors and the recipients and see if there's really traction, which I think there is.
I do, too.
And then our next step is to find a permanent location so that it doesn't have to be a pop-up event. It can be an ongoing. Yeah, and it's like a river. It's like things come in, things go out, and it just keeps moving. So that's what we hope to do after we kind of gauge the success of this. We have to, fundraise some more and build our board and all of that. But I, judging just from what we've been able to accomplish in the last couple months, I do think that there's definitely a need and an opportunity to really, help businesses who want to do something good, know how to do it and make it really easy for them, and then to help, teachers and also nonprofits, people who work for social service agencies or senior homes or, childcare, people who can be creative and know what to do with things that, after a while, other people and other businesses don't need.
Well, and also the notion of recycling has been, I think, in this town, slightly disappointing. Instead of recycling, people are just dumping stuff. And this is another way, don't you think? This is a much more viable way to creatively recycle stuff that many companies and places are just throwing in the garbage.
Absolutely. In fact, there's one of these similar organizations that's in Detroit called Arts and Scraps, and they do something that I think is really interesting. They get industrial surplus and just kind of leftovers, and they'll get a big pile of something, and they'll make some kind of a class project or a kit out of it, and then they will put it in all these bags, and teachers can buy, kits for their students on how to build a digestive system out of pipe cleaners and, leftover washers or something. Carolyn said, trash is a failure of imagination.
Oh, how
nice.
That's
one of our guiding principles.
Yeah.
Is that there's almost nothing that actually is really trash.
Well, not to be too, there are also tax deductible incentives for places too, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
true. That is, if you don't just feel like being, if you're not really just a good person, but you want to save yourself some dough, that's another interesting aspect of this, because that for many people can also be a real motivating factor to give stuff away if there is some benefit to them too.
Absolutely. And we do have our 501c3, so we are able to give people, tax write-off for their donations. And certainly for certain items, larger quantities or, fancier things, that actually can make a big difference.
I think you people should, if you were as intrigued by this Creative Chicago Reuse Exchange as I am, and again, the website is creativeshyrx.org. On the website, they have a sort of most wanted list, which includes arts and crafts supplies, office supplies, tools, hardware, musical instruments, metal, wood, equipment, containers, miscellaneous, surplus and outdated stock, furniture and lighting. One of the great things about this, Barb Kennan, and you have been a fantastic guest, the equal and maybe even better than your fantastic husband, Tim Samuelson, who I've talked to 1,000 times on the radio. So tell him that. The great thing about this, Barb, is it is going to spur the creative juices of not only teachers, but then in turn allow them to take this back to the classroom where the ripple effect could be profound. I really
Absolutely.
Believe that. Just profound.
I agree.
Barb, and again, I say that Lois, wherever she is she's smiling at these dogs, these German shepherds who are all over the city. She is thrilled by this idea. Barb, I'll check in with you after next week. Don't exhaust
okay.
yourself, but it's a wonderful idea. It's all going to take place from about 10 to 4, Monday, Tuesday, mm-hmm. and Wednesday. They will be at the Chicago Teachers Union Center at 1901 West Carroll. Carroll and Damon, very convenient. Mm-hmm. Taking in stuff that you people don't want, and the other 2 days giving that stuff to teachers who need it badly. Barb, take care of your sweet self and give Tim a hug.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Oh, my God, I'm so behind this. It's fabulous. Fabulous. What a great, great, great idea. This is going to take off like crazy. Roger Badish coming up. Letting Steve Wade play a little so Roger Badish can make his way into the studio. And here he is. We are not going to devote this segment of the life and times of Roger Badish much to his the continuation of his career, because this is going to be an ongoing thing as long as I'm ambulatory.
God bless you.
Because we haven't even gotten to his teaching career, why he came back to news, blah, 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 blah. It was interesting. You came in to say hi to Walter Jacobson last weekend. I thought that was really fun.
Well,
he was good, I thought. He's 80 years
excellent.
Old.
Excellent. Are you kidding? I want to be like him when I'm 80.
Yeah.
I want to be 80.
Yeah. No kidding. No, I thought it was really worth having Walter on just to talk about. That's an interesting career.
History. The history of everything he's done in broadcasting in this town and the changes that he and Bill Curtis, the tremendous jump forward in news presentation on television in this town that those two made, it was akin to what happened at Channel 7 when they brought in the quote-unquote happy news.
Happy talk, yeah.
Which I think I might have mentioned in high school, I sat in on one of the broadcasts because Bill Frink's daughter went to Evanston Township High School.
You never told me this.
I don't think we've hit on this. I was in high school, and I knew his daughter went to school there. They lived in Evanston.
Yeah.
And I asked her, could I hang out at Channel 7 with her dad one time? I was there from the morning. He took me around all the place, sat in the newsroom, watched everyone do their thing, saw John Coleman and his weather maps and his machines, and I sat in the studio, off by the door, watching them do the entire newscast. I can still, to this day, draw you an exact copy of that news set.
Oh, my God. What did you think, Roger? What did you think? The Happy Talk was a big deal and a ratings monster for a time. I'm not sure it was in retrospect, mm-hmm. When you have, certain stories that, and there were more, there were certainly more murders in Chicago in those days than there are now. It wasn't, I think it's looked at as some kind of like, you know, bozo show at night, and it really wasn't that. There was a lightness to it. How would you
describe
that?
There was a lightness, but it was a serious newscast. You had serious professionals presenting the news.
Yeah.
And Fahey Flynn, you don't get any more serious and professional.
Or distinguished.
Distinguished.
Yeah.
Joel Daly, also, who... Again, a child meeting his heroes when he comes into the after SAG auditions, and then I'm able to perform with him on some of the presentations.
Did you ever see Joel do his Daryl one-man show?
No.
Oh, fantastic. You can imagine.
Oh, I can,
You can imagine.
Just a warm, loving, wonderful human being. Bill Frink, very serious, a sports professional.
Yeah.
Now you got John Coleman, who... unbeknownst to me at the time, was destined for even greater things, the Weather Channel inventor. And he had to have designed that cube, which is what that was.
Exactly.
And he has a foot lock down on the floor that he would step on and turn the cube. And you would have a green screen on one, you'd have an actual map on another, all that stuff. And so he had the fun stuff, but, you know, most weather people now on TV are the, kind of the light entertainment.
Well, let's remind, I don't have to remind
many, go back to PJ
many
Hoff.
Of the listeners. Yes, PJ Hoff, who had smiling faces, but also this era in Chicago where they had weather bunnies.
Oh, yes.
Remember the weather bunnies who were very, very attractive women?
Mm-hmm.
And bunnies was the word for Playboy models.
Exactly, which
and there was
born
a,
in Chicago. There,
yes, and there was a whole, you know, a period in this town where one station, they may still be doing it for all I can see now. I won't mention many names, but that was about as frivolous as it could get.
Well, because you couldn't play with the news.
Right.
And you couldn't play with the sports. I mean, you could kind of play with the sports.
Sure.
You know, show some bloopers.
Well, Weigel's wieners and
exactly.
that stuff, yeah.
But you couldn't do anything. The weather, everyone took seriously because they wanted to know if they were going to get rained on. But everyone kind of knew that back in the day, before weather radar and satellites and all this other stuff, it was kind of a catch-as-catch-can forecast.
It was like, P.J. Huff's like... The something in charge of looking out the window is
right.
what he called it.
Let's take a look at the weather. And he'd look at the window. Yeah. It's if you could, I always go back to the hippy dippy weatherman.
Yeah.
George Carlin. You know, and what the weather radar is picking up.
Yeah. You know? Well, Walter one day is going to come back because he left.
Stories to tell.
Again, much like you, who has had an interesting, fascinating career in this town, we barely touched on him.
Yeah.
We didn't even get him to the point. Where he had to be convinced, he was telling me off air, to join Bill Curtis as an anchorman. He didn't want to be an anchorman.
Really?
And that is arguably the most successful anchor team in this town.
So successful that even though Channel 7 has maintained the same semblance of the origin of Happy Talk News.
Right.
And I hate calling it Happy
Talk. Yeah, same here.
But the same semblance and every other station in town picked up on it and tried to do it better, and if you look at the ratings, have not been able to.
I know.
The pairing of those two, not just the pairing, but putting them in the newsroom.
That was the key.
That was unheard of.
Yep.
And they tried to bring them back.
Channel
2 tried to recapture
magic. Like two or three years ago.
It wasn't that long ago.
It was not that long ago. And
so
it didn't
you can
work.
See the
Well, but
success.
It was also... It seemed to me to just be a not a joke, but a real ratings grab. And I think they only had them on early in the afternoon.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It would have been very – you really want to try this? Bosses at Channel 2, put them on at 10.
Yeah.
That's what I would do.
See what happens.
You mentioned the SAG-AFTRA senior radio players in discussing the great Joel Daly. They have a show coming up on August 10th at 7 o'clock at the Chicago Cultural Center, which is easily accessible, Michigan and Randolph, the old main branch of the Chicago Public Library, and the beautiful Claudia Cassidy Theater. Claudia Cassidy, former legendary drama critic of the Chicago Tribune. How long have you been involved with these folks?
I've been involved with the senior radio players for maybe... I want to say 5 years, about 5 years, five and a half years.
How
and I took that year off when I was sick.
Sure.
I wasn't able to perform or anything.
How and why did you get involved?
Well, since I was a little kid, I've always loved radio.
That we know. That okay. we have heard in episode one of The Life and Times of Roger Bennett.
But I used to listen to a lot of the old mm-hmm. radio shows, The Breakfast Club. There were still old-time radio shows known as the Golden Age of radio back when I was growing up. So we're talking mid-50s when I discovered radio and what it could bring. And I enjoyed them so much that throughout my early life, I kept exploring that and loved it so much that when I got into junior high, I found in the library, I went out and sought out books on old-time radio. Mm. I found encyclopedias on it, and I have forgotten more than I knew.
Yeah.
Because I haven't stayed up with it on that level because I've had other things to focus on.
Yes, you were working for Harold Washington. You were working for Jane Byrne. Yes. I was distracted by the mayors of the city
just
of Chicago.
Slightly. But I've always enjoyed it. And then when I started teaching, I had heard about the After SAG senior radio players, but I wasn't senior at the time.
Right.
So, because this was like 25, 24 years ago. But I got in touch with, those were the days.
Chuck Shaden.
Chuck Shaden had given his approval for two groups, a North Side and a South Side group, to use the title, Those Were the Days, Radio Players.
Mm-hmm.
And I hooked up with the people on the North Side. And I started pulling scripts and rewriting stuff and pulling sound effects and purchasing a sound system and helping them book sites and performing with them. And we had a blast. Unfortunately, I then started teaching full-time and was not able to continue with the group. We did that for 2 years I was with them.
Sounds like you loved it.
I do.
Yeah.
You know how much I love radio. This is a vital, important part of radio and Chicago broadcast history, as the majority of the shows were done here in Chicago.
Yeah. I think people forget that.
Yeah.
I think people forget
that. We throw around the Chicago School of Broadcasting name kind of haphazardly nowadays. But New York was not the center of broadcasting. L.A. was not the center of broadcasting. Everyone came to Chicago to write, produce, create, and broadcast radio programs.
We're going to talk about Roger's distinct and particular involvement with this upcoming show, which is August 10th, 7 o'clock. It's free also, ladies and gentlemen.
Doors open at 6.
Doors open at no tickets needed. Doors at 6, shows at 7. We'll talk about what exactly he's going to do, and then I'm going to play you a thing. I'm going to play for Roger, too. You know, Mark and Maureen Shulman, who were in here, the guys who run the Eli's Cheesecake, are having a show next Sunday to benefit the Happiness Club, which is a group that it's sort of like this. I mean, it's a it's a group that sort of teaches kids to express themselves. So I'm going to play a song from that and you will listen to.
I know
to,
we haven't too. Touched on the teaching thing yet, but
that's for
the 20 years of teaching broadcasting, that was the first exercise that my students did within the history of broadcasting that I taught was an old-time radio show that they all produced.
Fantastic. Roger Bettish, the one and only. We'll be right back. Stephen Wade, the one and only. Cross America is his new CD. I'm here with Roger Bettish, who's going to be performing with the SAG-AFTRA Senior Radio Players. It's a professional group, ladies and gentlemen. They recreate old-time classic radio. They've been doing so for roughly two decades now, since the late mid-90s. August 10th, 7 o'clock, doors open at about 6, 6:30. Cultural Center's Claudia Cassidy Theater. What are you doing?
We're doing two episodes. We have an Arch Obler play called Rocket from Manhattan.
That's a good title.
It's a great script. It's about these three people who, for science, take off in a rocket, circle around the moon, and the interactions and the thoughts? Because Arch Obler touched on subjects that were so ethereal and thought-provoking in whatever genre he wrote in that this is going to have you in your seats and thinking by the time they're done.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a great script. It's about a half an hour. And then we are doing a episode of Suspense, or excuse me, Escape. Mm-hmm. I keep getting the two mixed up.
Yeah.
Escape. And this one is a Western. And this is why I like Escape so much. And I've talked with Carl Amari a lot.
You think you're a cowboy? Yeah. Because you relate to cowboys.
Howdy, y'all.
You're urban cowboy.
Yeah,
Evanston cowboy.
But Escape touched on so many different genres. It would have science fiction, it have westerns, it have film noir type stuff. And you never knew what the story was, and it just kind of pulled you away. This one is a western called Wild Jack Rhett. And again, it kind of makes you think at the end. And I am the narrator, which in this case you might not think is a big role, like something at the beginning.
I think that's typecasting. What are you doing? Narrator.
Well, you sound like a narrator, you know?
Yeah.
You don't sound like a sheriff.
Yeah, you'll be the newsreader in this thing.
But actually in this, the narrator has quite a role in maintaining the story and the movement of it and setting the atmosphere.
Do you guys rehearse?
Yeah, we just had a rehearsal. We just had a rehearsal Friday, and it went great. We have about 12, 15 people in it.
Wow.
Because we've added some commercials to it and stuff. And it's great. Again, for your listeners, we throw the term SAG after.
Yeah, right. Screen Actors Guild and the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists.
Right. And so these are people who professionally...
Union members.
Union, yes. Very strong union members who perform TV, films, radio, commercials,
voiceover
work, and we're nationwide. It's not just here in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
If your kids watch cartoons, people who are voicing those cartoons are union members. If you're watching a TV show, they're all union members. If you watch a film, they're all union members. So that's what we're a part of.
Yeah, they're pros.
Yeah,
they're
extreme.
Real pros.
And what was great was, and not that many still around, but some of the members, the older members, were actually in some of these shows back in the 40s.
Wow.
And it's amazing to talk with them.
Oh, I'll bet.
And
I'm
in awe.
Well, this for you, it's like, you know, it's like heroin. I mean, this is your... You know, this is like,
you see, I'm
this is
jumping
like,
in my
this
seat.
Is like your fix. I mean, to hear from the people that you listened to as a kid.
It is.
Wow.
Yeah.
You want to read something? Do you have a clip?
We do. So after the announcer starts the show and the theme on Wild Jack Rhett, and we're all set with our little music. I brought a little music to help out. I would have brought my little red bandana.
I would have seen that.
And your narrator begins. Red Mesa. A little town springing out of the hot, dry prairie beside the Chisholm Trail. A saloon, a hotel, two general stores, and a tiny church where the decent citizenry might pray for salvation, while a wilder element, trail driver, teamster, buffalo hunter, restlessly searched out friend and enemy along the dusty main street. A small hill rose on the western edge of Red Mesa, plagued with a rash of graves, some marked and cared for, others sinking and forgotten. As the town buried their recently slain sheriff, killed by the outlaw Todd Mallon, a committee of the leading citizens of Red Mesa gathered together at Mayor Wayne's home to decide upon a new sheriff.
Mm. That's great. That's great. I just sense the joy you get from doing this kind of thing. You don't get paid to do it.
Well, no.
No, of course not.
Actually, the senior players do this free.
Yeah.
And that's why we have free admission.
Yeah.
I constantly get looks from my wife, even though after 40 years of marriage, she's kind of used to it.
Hey, if she stayed this long, you'd let her look.
She's accused me of loving this more than I love her.
Oh, nonsense. Yeah. I know how much you love her.
I know.
But you do love this.
Oh, God, do I love her.
Yeah.
Oh. I really do. I could do this 24/7.
August 10th, Thursday?
Yeah.
Thursday at 7 o'clock at the Chicago Cultural Center, Michigan and Randolph, the old main branch of the Chicago Public Library on the second floor. Claudia Cassidy Theater is a great space. It is a great space.
And if you want to hang out a little before, the Tiffany Tower Room or the Tiffany Ceiling Room is right there.
Yeah.
Want to walk around a little bit.
If you haven't been to the Cultural Center, it is certainly worth spending a great deal of time there. Yeah. Roger Badish and 14 or 15 of his closest friends will be doing this thing.
That's right.
You know, it is amazing to me, ever amazing to me, all the stuff that goes on in Chicago, and there's just not – there's no chance to see it all. You know, you met Mark and Maureen Shulman of Eli's Cheesecake fame. They've got – they are very behind a thing called the Happiness Club, and there's a benefit for the Happiness Club next Sunday at 6:30 at Park West. They are honoring a guy named Chris Lee as Artist of the Year, who is currently appearing as Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson in the production of Hamilton. Here, Maureen sent a song. Listen to this kid sing. This is some song that Michelle Obama loves and that is of an official song of some food drive or something. But it's a cool song. And this is the Happiness Club is an organization that tries to foster and give kids across the city a chance to, just as you were getting to express yourself, to express themselves through the arts and the performing arts. Here he is singing. This kid's good. You got it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh. Yeah. Oh. Come on. You've got the power to change all the things you do. So get out the seat, get on your feet. It's time to work out and make that move. I'm going to show you how. Show people better. Think out the box. Yeah, be aware. People around you influence how you grow. So don't hesitate. You got to let it flow. It's not so hard when you say yes, yes, yes. I'll take control into my best. Say you don't approve, it's time you shine in, find your own way. No time to wait, procrastinate, it's do or die, you gotta motivate. Deep down inside you know you wanna be, no time to rest, you gotta live the dream. Power lies right here with you, you and me. I know you make it if you
That is a great tune, don't you think, Roger? Yeah, this kid should be performing at Lollapalooza.
Yeah.
But he's got a steady job. He's performing as Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson's Chicago production of Hamilton. He will be the featured star and the guest of honor at the Happiness Club benefit. It is Sunday, 6:30 at Park West. It is thehappinessclub.com. For all the information you may need. It's a fun event. I've been to a couple over the years because Mark and Maureen Shulman are the great benefactors and promoters of this thing. Roger Badish, sitting right here, will be August 10th, Thursday night. You nervous to be part of this show?
I'm excited. I channel my nervousness.
You don't rattle at all, do you?
I rattle, but I channel my nervousness. It's what I always used to teach my kids who were afraid to go in front of a microphone.
Huh.
They couldn't stand. I made them wear headsets. Several students couldn't stand it. They would take the headsets off. I'd come up behind them and hold the headsets over their ears and make them listen to themselves as they did newscasts or old-time radio shows or whatever. And then other times they would swivel in their seat because they were nervous, but their hands were in their laps instead of operating the audio board, which they had to do. I'd come up behind them and hold the seat still and then take their hands and put them on the audio board. So I try to learn from my own lessons, channel the nervous energy into the performance. And, I mean, I'm good with it. The problem, one of the other reasons why I do the radio, I think, is because I can't memorize lines. I have a trouble memorizing lines.
You're on book.
Yeah,
all
I can't,
the time,
you know, it's like every 5 seconds I'll be saying script, line,
yeah, right,
you know.
Line, help. Roger will be performing with the SAG after senior radio players this Thursday night at 7 o'clock.
And also, we will not be at Claudia Cassidy Theater for the rest of the year. They have a show coming in that's taking up the space. But we will be, later in the year, performing shows at Chief O'Neill's.
On Elston Avenue,
yes.
One of the great bar restaurants in
we'll
Chicago.
We'll have four or five additional shows coming up. And if you go to the SAG AFTER website and check out the details, you'll see the announcements come out.
We're together in this. We will promote every one of these
shows.
You
got a deal.
Plus, I love Chief O'Neill's.
You want to come out and try out?
Thank you. No. I'm too nervous. We got to take a break. I'll read this very slowly because Roger has to... Stephen Wade, Chicago's own, with his latest CD, Across America. When I was filling in some time ago on, for, I guess, John Williams, I don't remember, I got to spend a few minutes with R.J. Nelson, Bob Nelson, and his book, Dirty Waters, Confessions of Chicago's Last Harbor Boss. That 20 minutes was not enough, Bob. Now you're back for 45. Let's get to it again.
All right.
This is just a fascinating, fascinating, incredibly insightful book. I have never owned a boat. I have known people who own boats. But this is a subculture that is an incredibly important subculture in Chicago, the boating world. Is it not?
It is. And Chicago's harbor system, I think, is the largest one in the country and one of the largest in the world.
How did you become, well, because all your predecessors went to prison. let's take us back. How did you become the last harbor boss?
Well, it's...
And more to the point, who preceded you, and what kind of clout did they have?
Well, it was always a political appointment, very political, and... Basically, it was ripe for bribery. With the advent of fiberglass boats, suddenly boats were affordable, they were cheap, and they required virtually no maintenance. So suddenly there was an explosion of boat purchases. And as we all know from our history, Chicago harbors were really lagoons. They weren't designed for boats. So there was very little place to put them. It was a question of supply and demand, and bribery became the way of life, the Chicago way, of course.
Initially, who in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, before this fiberglass thing, who owned boats? I mean, you had to be wealthy to own a boat, or...
Yes.
Yeah.
It was more of an upper-class thing, for sure. There have always been people... involved with sailing, racing, that kind of thing. Yacht clubs have been around long time, and I go into some detail on the importance of the yacht clubs in Chicago's harbor development. They were essential, and they still are, as a matter of fact. But why do people buy boats? You know, I sold boats for many years.
Yeah, I know.
After I left university life, and if someone would come in and say, you know, I really want to buy a boat, but I figured out what it's going to cost me each time I take it out. Uh-huh. Well, I knew that person would never buy a boat. People don't buy a boat for economic reasons, except I should point out that smaller boats that are used by people as their summer homes, their summer cottages, that does make some economic sense.
So
but
instead
only
of
if
buying,
you use them a lot.
Instead of buying a home in New Buffalo, for instance.
Right.
You can buy a boat, and you can live on your boat, can't you?
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, very few people realize this, but a boat is considered a second home. As long as it has a toilet, a head, a kitchen, a galley, You can mortgage a boat up to 30 years, and all the interest is deductible.
Get out of here.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Not that I've ever thought of owning a boat. But try to characterize it. This whole fiberglass thing in the 60s started to happen.
Yeah.
That about right?
Yeah.
And so boats became affordable. And I know there are a million, there got to be a million different answers to this question. But why then? Who were these people who were buying boats, who were fueling this explosion of boat buying?
Well, again, because they were mass-produced and they were inexpensive, suddenly you had middle-class people. You had school teachers. You had cops, firemen, all kinds of people with ordinary lives saying, you know, if we buy a boat, it's a lot cheaper. We don't have to do the kind of maintenance you have on a summer home. And by God, we can take it anywhere we want. But one of the real reasons people buy boats is there used to be a plaque that people would put on their boats. I'm talking 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It said, the captain's word is law. Okay, and you go, what does that mean? Well, the point is, once you get outside of a harbor on a boat, there are no stop signs. There's no traffic lights. There's no,
there
it's
no...
you, and it's an individual
freedom.
Freedom, exactly.
So let's go back to when you became. How did you? What year was it? And how did you become harbor master? And more to the point, I got to hear about your predecessors too.
Okay. Well, I've been asked this question, and honestly, I don't really know.
Yeah, I know you don't know. Yeah, I know.
And I tried.
It's a great mystery.
It's a great mystery. But basically, my predecessor, Gerald Pfeiffer. Who was brought in as a reformer, by the way, 10 years prior to my getting the job in 1987. And he became corrupted. He was one of four of my predecessors who all went to federal prison for accepting bribes for slips. So how did I get in? I don't know. What happened was I had been working at the University of Chicago in student stuff, and I got tired of it, I had a small sailboat. And the boatyard guy said, why don't you sell boats? You're pretty good at with people. So I did it part-time and then decided to do it full-time. Well, I was selling boats into this corrupt system, and not a weekend went by that I didn't have to deal with the corruption and the paper bags full of money and all that stuff. And it almost cost me my livelihood because my predecessor said you'll never get a mooring because I didn't cooperate, I believe was the word. But then it was clear when Harold Washington was elected and then got control of the Park District Board that and then Pfeiffer was under investigation.
There might be some real
reform.
There's
going to be a real change.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get out of my mind that I was the right guy for the job. And so I started writing letters. I wrote to Walter Netsch, who was president of the board.
Sure.
I networked with people who knew Walter Netsch and so forth and so on. Nothing. I got nothing. Finally, I went to my alderman, Larry Bloom, who himself was later indicted.
In the Fifth Ward,
A friend of mine. And said, you know, I don't understand. I can't get any response. He said, well, you're going the wrong way. You need to talk to Jesse Madison. I said, who's he? I didn't know who he was. So the only thing that happened was Larry Bloom got me an interview with Jesse. And we sat down for about a half an hour, 45 minutes, and we just hit it off. And he said, I think I want to hire you. And by the way, it turned out we both worked for Saul Alinsky.
Wow.
Years previously.
Yeah, sure.
In a former
life. Saul Alinsky, the great, great organizer,
And so forth. But he said, you know, there are all these problems in the Park District. Walter Netsch is trying to run the place, so I'll let you know. Well, time went by. Nothing happened. I'd call. I'd get put off. I never talked to Jesse. 7 months went by, and finally I got a call from the general attorney, George Gallen at the time, and he said, you still interested in the job of harbor director? This was a Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock.
It's a great Chicago political story.
Yeah.
It really is.
And I said, yeah, sure. And he said, well, when can you be available? I said, well, I've sold a whole bunch of boats, and I have to get those commissioned. I said, let's see, it's March, the middle of March. probably the end of May, first part of June. There was a dramatic pause.
Yeah, sure.
And he said, no, Monday morning. What time can you start? He said, they are escorting your predecessor out as
to
we
jail.
Speak.
Yeah, he's going to jail. What a
so that's
great
how experience. I got the job.
We will talk to Bob, RJ, his nom de plume, RJ Nelson. The book is Dirty Waters, Confessions of Chicago's Last Harbor Boss. You now know how he became Last Harbor's Boss, the Last Harbor Boss. Now hear what he did as the last one. Steve Wade and the voice of Mira Kogan and my guest RJ Nelson, Bob Nelson, the author of a fascinating book, Dirty Waters, Confessions of Chicago's Last Harbor Boss. We just heard him talk about how he became Last Hardware Boss, following in the footsteps of four very, very corrupt and jailed predecessors. The temptations were aplenty, were they not, Bob, when you got that job?
Yes, they were.
How many slips were you in charge of, basically?
There were about 5,000. Now, that included half of those were just buoy moorings, mm-hmm. which you had to tie your boat up
sure.
to out in open water. Now they've replaced a lot of those with actual walk-on slips, which we were doing while I was there. But the total was about... just under 5,000.
So some people with a little extra money in their pocket thought that you might want some of that money to give them preferential, whatever
yes.
preferential treatment is in the harbors of
yes.
Chicago.
Yes. Oh, I was offered. And you know, what was interesting is the FBI was in my office like every day. You know, when they took me up to go into my office after I got the job, the front door of my inner office was all smashed in. I said, what happened? Oh, the FBI did that. I said, what are you talking about? Nobody would give them the key. And as a matter of fact, the same thing happened to Jesse Madison when he went over. They would not give him the key to Ed Kelly's office. I mean, it was just chaos. And it was the old system, changing into the new, and it was chaotic.
But they did. You were, in classic sense, a reformer. You knew how
right.
things ran.
Right.
You knew that things were not on the square, and you came in and you were going to make them on the square, right?
Right. We did a bunch of things, which are outlined in the book, but basically there was no rule in the harbor rules against bribing a harbor master to get a slip. We changed that.
Yeah, yeah.
Along with a lot of other things. And then we, just about changed it. I formed harbor councils and found out what the boaters wanted in each harbor. We would do harbor walks because every harbor is different.
Sure.
The neighborhoods, there's a whole chapter on the...
Yeah, I know. It's wonderful. Wonderful.
The different neighborhoods that the harbors are. So we did that, and there's some nice pictures of how bad the facilities were for years and years and years. The harbors were basically a cash cow, both for political fundraising and but also for the Park District.
How would someone go about it? If you had stepped in there, you're in there for 3 days, and I just bought a boat. Is it a direct appeal to you, or I want a slip? Who do I write to?
Right. The movers and shakers, the people who wanted a boat slip, would call their alderman or their representative or a judge or...
someone who they thought would have some club.
U.S. congressman. If I had gotten a call from the President of the United States for someone's boat slip, I wouldn't have been surprised. I swear to God. That's how many calls.
Did you ever get a call from an Illinois senator?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And congressman, yeah.
About a boat slip.
Yeah. Yeah.
Saying, hey, can you congratulations on your new job.
Exactly.
Can you help out my friend?
Exactly. So what we did was we computerized the – there was a long waiting list for slips, obviously, because of the supply and demand thing. And so we put in a computerized system that was based on your deposit. You had to put a deposit down when you applied for a slip. And the Treasury Department issued you a computerized receipt number, and that's what we used to do the assignment.
What would people do if they didn't have a slip? Where would they keep their boat?
Well, fortunately
I've never had a boat, so
marinas
all my questions...
were being built. Waukegan was built, and it was
outside
slips.
Of the city.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Chicago boaters have gone to many places on Lake Michigan for generations, basically, for a variety of reasons. The marina in Hammond was being built.
On your watch.
On my watch.
Yeah.
And I ultimately became the CEO down there after...
After you left, yeah.
After Daley fired me. So.
Yeah. Why did Daley fire you? Just a change in administration?
It was a change in administrations, and he was wanting to privatize everything. If you recall, he wrote this big,
sure
long
do.
Op-ed piece in the New York Times.
Yep.
The paradigm that he and Claypool, who was head of the Park District at the time, they changed. Whereas I saw the harbors as neighborhoods with their own little subculture and important part of Chicago and all that, they saw the harbors as parking lots for boats.
Yeah.
And so they privatized the system.
Is that smart or stupid?
Well, in my opinion...
That's all I care about.
I don't know if I use the word stupid, but it was
misguided.
Misguided.
Yeah.
And I think I quote the head of Westrek, which is a California outfit that has managed them all these years. And he said in an article that it's one of the greatest cash cows the Park District will ever have. Well, I never looked at it that way.
Yeah.
And you did.
I mean, the way you, in Dirty Waters, and again, R.J. Nelson's book is Dirty Waters, Confessions of Chicago's Last Harbor Boss, is incredibly insightful about the way one subculture in this politically nutty city worked. And it's a subculture that unless you have a boat, you don't really know much about, but you really should, because it's reflective of the ways it can be venal, it can be idiotic, and you keep talking about this whole notion of cash cow. It can also be utterly fascinating. You remind me of the bribe that had something to do with Acapulco.
There were people would make appointments, obviously.
Yeah.
And they would, you know, let's say an alderman say, I want you to meet this guy.
Sure.
He wants to talk to you about his boat. Well, sure, that was my job.
Right.
I talked to everybody. And so this guy came in and he said, you know, I have a penthouse condo down in Acapulco.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Good for you.
And I have this boat I need to slip. How would you like to spend 2 weeks in my penthouse anytime you want with a companion? I will provide a companion for you, gender of your choice.
Jesus, what do you say to someone who comes in and says that to you?
I was getting so used to things that I just said, get out.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
Sometimes
it was straight money. I mean, it was
straight. Sometimes it was crass. Other times it was, I'll never forget that I was called up to the commissioner's office and the secretary handed me an envelope and it just happened the director of security was sitting there. And I opened the envelope, you know, just kind of chatting with him, and 10 brand new $20 bills fell out of a boat application along with the check for the deposit.
Jesus.
And this was by one of the commissioners, one of his constituents, and oh my goodness, what we didn't go through on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, what are you going to do, accuse the commissioner?
Right.
He, of course, didn't know anything about it, and it went on and on and on and on.
And you were good about it. I mean, you did. You were never tempted. I'm not making you sound holier than thou, but you're an honest man in a position that is made for dishonesty.
Exactly. I guess I was brought up that way.
Yeah.
And many times I thought I was going to be fired for not cooperating.
Yeah, right, sure, not playing the game.
But that's not why, well, maybe it was, but the interesting thing is that I had been there a year, and the boss was not Jesse Madison. I was given over to a gentleman named Tom Elsey, who was kicked out of City Hall, he and Mayor Washington, sure. All that stuff in the background of Chicago. And then he left. And so the Harbors were part of special services, which was Harbors, Golf, Soldier Field Stadium, concessions, blah, blah, blah. And so he had this little going-away meeting, and he thanked us all. And then he said, okay, Bob, it's your meeting. Now, this was on April 1st, April Fool's Day. I'd only been there 1 year.
Wow.
And I said, what are you talking about? I thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
He said, didn't Jesse tell you? You are in charge of all the special services on the lakefront.
What a way to run a city. my guess for another, here, get some news, and I'm going to keep R.J. Nelson, Bob Nelson, my new friend, author of Dirty Waters, Confessions of Chicago's Last Harbor Bus. It's incredibly insightful about the city and how the city works, one aspect of it works. And it's also a rollicking good ride. The way he describes the various harbors and the reflective of being neighborhoods, in a sense, with hierarchies and all the things that go along with Chicago neighborhoods. And it's very anecdotal, a lot of good, good stories. About 10 more minutes with Bob Nelson talking about Dirty Waters, Confessions of Chicago's Last Harbor Bus. It is his first book. It is likely not to be his last book because he had a fascinating life before this, during this, which there are more stories, and after this. What's the best harbor in Chicago, Bob? If I had a boat, where would I want to be and why?
Wow. Well, you...
And I didn't have to pay under the table to get in there.
Well, the Burnham Harbor was always the gold plater harbor.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had a 40, 50, 60-foot boat, at least when I was there, that's where you'd want to go. Or Belmont. So
yeah.
You had the downtown Burnham and the north side.
Belmont. I remember the Regenstein had... there was a huge boat in Belmont Harbor when I was a kid, mm-hmm. owned by the Regenstein family. I remember looking at it, it looked like a yacht to me. When you left, when Daley came in, and, you know, a change of regime, and he wanted to privatize everything, though that may have been a terrible mistake because there were other terrible privatization mistakes.
Right.
Were you sad or were you relieved?
A little bit of both.
Yeah.
My wife said the furrows on my forehead suddenly shrank. But I was very sad because Chicago is my love.
Yeah.
I'm a third-generation Southsider, and always thought I should write Daley a letter about the Northsiders coming. They were coming down to the golf courses, and that he should have the bridges in the up position to keep the Northsiders from coming down, except a nuclear attack or something. So I'm a third generation Chicagoan, and you couldn't pry me out of the city.
But you went to work in Hammond, though.
Well, I
needed a job.
They called me.
Did
and,
they?
Yes.
They recruited
the
you.
The only time anybody ever called me for a job.
Wow. But they recruited you after you had
they
left.
They did. Yes.
And what was that? What were the differences with the?
Well, Hammond, they had built this marina. And
this wasn't when they were building the casinos too.
It was because of the marina that there was a casino.
Gotcha.
But that was before the marina was built, and it was a huge marina. Marinas are built. The number of slips that are built in a marina is designed to pay for the bond that it's going to cost to build it.
Gotcha.
Okay, so. So it was 1,300 slips, and that's what they needed, and that's what their marketing people said, oh, well, I'll come down from Chicago, you know, and you'll fill the thing up in 2 years. Well,
no.
No, because boating is like real estate. It's location, location, location. So when I went down there, instead of 1,000 boaters, there were 200. And that and it was bankrupt. It was on a junk bond. The city council hated the Port Authority. It was
did
a
they
mess.
Think you were going to increase the number of boats there?
Oh, yes.
That's what,
which I did, yeah.
Yeah. How'd you do that?
Well,
just convincing people that it was...
Part of it was I reached out to boaters. For instance, I did a little survey of boat dealers around the southern part of Lake Michigan. And none of them had even heard of Hammond, including a dealer in Hammond. He had heard of
it,
but he'd never even been there.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So
wow.
So we had open houses. We did all kinds of stuff. And then we're able to build things that fulfilled boaters' needs far better than Chicago. And with all due respect, Chicago, because the harbors are inside of parks, it's very difficult to provide the kinds of amenities that boaters can find in Hammond or North
Park. What? What's a good amenity?
Well, parking.
Oh.
Winter
like
storage in the parking lots.
Uh-huh.
Little restaurants or good store, ship stores, that kind of thing. So so basically I went down there and my office was a trailer. And in my...
But it was an interesting challenge for you, was it not?
It was one of the greatest things because... The mayor, who was a Republican, the only Republican in Lake County, Indiana, that was ever elected, and I met with him. First of all, I was hired by the Port Authority, and I get this call one day from this guy, and he said, you want to meet the mayor of Hammond? I said, well, sure. I was there about 3 months.
Yeah. Know?
So I go down to this meeting, and the mayor comes in, or all these people, all these, they look like department heads, and the mayor apologized. He got to his little podium in the big mayor's office and said there was some emergency. He had to leave. So I turned to this guy and said, this looks like a department head meeting. He said, it is. You're a department head.
Wow.
I said, what? I said, I work for the Port Authority.
Yeah.
Well, you also report to the mayor. You'll be here every Monday morning at 8:30 for our staff meetings. It was like, holy crap. Well, anyway, I did meet with him, and I said, well, what kind of a marina? Because once the casino arrived, which was like 5 years instead
of
1.5 years, they told me it would be, we had plenty of cash to build facilities that met the boaters' expectations. And so after 2 or 3 years with the new building, we had waiting lists.
Wow, that's amazing.
And 90% of the boaters were from Chicagoland.
Yeah.
Chicago and suburbs.
How long would it take for a decent boat to get from Hammond to Chicago?
It's 10 miles by sea.
That's it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you can see Chicago from Hammond.
Do you have a boat now?
I do.
What kind?
I have a little sailboat, a little 23-footer Pearson yacht. It was built in the 60s. It's fiberglass, one of the earliest.
Yeah.
But I don't keep it in Chicago.
Where do you keep it?
Up in Michigan. We have a summer place up there.
Bob, it's a fascinating life and a fascinating book. R.J. Nelson's Dirty Waters, Confessions of Chicago's Last Harbor Boss. When did you, in the few minutes we have, when did you start to write the book and why?
Well, as I mentioned in the in the book, as soon as I got into the office, I could tell I was there were people trying to set me up to get fired, rid of me. And it was very clear from various angles. And I got a call from Barry Cronin of the Sun-Times, who was a reporter.
I know Barry well.
Who did a lot of the harbor investigative stuff. And he said, I'll never forget it. He said, Bob, I hate to call. And he did a beautiful portrait of me in the Sun-Times. He said, I hate to call you, but my boss, the publisher of the Sun-Times, wants a slip for his friend, the CEO of Carson Peary Scott.
Oh, my God.
And I said, why are you calling me? What are you talking about? And he said, believe me, it's the last thing I want to do, but can you help him out? Well, I exploded and told him to
tell
the publisher to go to hell. And
maybe that's why Barry
right
left
after
the
that phone call, I realized how fragile my position was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I started taking notes and keeping copies of files and clippings and all that. Nothing classified, nothing
right, yeah, sure.
But I wound up when I got fired with a four-drawer file cabinet full of files.
Well, they have served you well, and I certainly hope, I'm telling you people, Dirty Waters, Confessions of Chicago's Last Harbor Boss is a book that anybody who cares about the city of Chicago, as does Bob Nelson, should have on their bookshelf. I hope and I pray there's another book in you, Bob.
Yes.
And good. I'm glad to hear that. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. Three-generation Southsider, but he got some real insights into the way the city works, and it's a wonderful narrative read. It's not all about corruption. It's about life on the water. Bob, it's always great to talk to you. I'm glad we could expand this a bit.
Well, thank you very much.
And you'll be back with the next book, too.
Okay.
No question. We'll take a little break, and then we will talk to David Floodstrand about the Rush Street reunion. Stay tuned.
Back in the days when the railroad was first pushing into the out-of-the-way sections of the country, St. Elmo County already had the reputation of being home to the most contrary, negative, stubborn, pessimistic man in the state. It wasn't for nothing they called him Hardhead Hardy. Hardhead just always saw the worst side of anything everybody else was for. Stubborn? If you used to throw him in a creek, he'd float upstream. So one day when Gabe, his 12-year-old son, came running in and said, "Pa, folks are talking about building a railroad into Dewdrop," Hardhead snorted, "Who would want to build anything in this butt end of creation? Why, if a rabbit wants to cross over to county..."
It's a fun CD. It's a fun CD. Also, generations of people have had fun on Rush Street. I have had fun on Rush Street. And my friend, David Floodstrand, who has been working on a book, all sorts of things about the street, started... 3 years ago, the Rush Street reunion, sort of to gather together people who had memories before we all get senile. It happens again. The latest Rush Street reunion will take place Sunday at Shenanigans. David, how are you?
Good evening. I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. This has turned into, I think, when you first started these reunions, you weren't quite sure what to expect, but, man, it's been explosive, has it not?
It's really been extraordinary, and I'm very pleased with how it's grown exponentially and the wonderful stories and the fact that we've been able to gather people together who have perhaps not seen each other for 20, 30 X amount of years, and to help to give some of that, you know, is pretty neat to be able to be involved with, you know, as well. So
have you heard? You must have heard some stories and things that you didn't really expect. I mean, the reunions must have been filled with surprises, and I suppose you're expecting even more this coming Sunday, right?
I certainly hope so. Yeah, and unfortunately, the last two have been fraught with me having to take care of duties that I would prefer not to.
Yeah, right.
Deal
right.
With
sure.
Being a host, you're like saying, "Why isn't why do you only have one bartender? There's 450 people here, and you know, making sure that we get chairs in the jazz room and this and that, all these other things that I wasn't ready for." Well. You know, I'm always ready to step up to the plate, but there were things that I really would have preferred to just sit and listen to people and talk to people. And that was my hope, you know, and I didn't do as much of that as I would have liked to. And perhaps this year will be the year where I can.
Yeah, well, it takes a while. I mean, it takes a while. This is only the third year. I mean, it takes a while for those things to kind of the growing pains, David Floodstrand,
yeah.
The growing pains. How is your book coming? You've been working on this for some time, Rush Street, Chicago's Street of Dreams, which is a proposed history of the street, which is really something you're biting off a lot here from, and the area, of course, from the 1880s into the 1980s. How's it coming? It must just be growing and growing and growing, huh?
It is. It's like the layers of the onion skin. You know, you open one door and then there are three more doors in front of you, and you open those and you're like, wow, I never expected, you know, this, and I never expected this, and how extraordinary. And things that people will tell me and the stories that, you know, and then I get to jump off, you know, from my notes to go and look for something else. And as being a, you know, a student of of history, you know, especially I love the regional history because everywhere I walk, it's like, that happened there, man. I wonder what happened here, you know, and those kinds of things. I've always been like that, and, you know, and especially seeing old so many of the old buildings in Chicago and in those areas like Old Town and Don and Rush Street. Not so much anymore, but
yeah,
at least we have, you know, photographs and, you know, bits and pieces here and there. So, you know, it's been an extraordinary thing. I really do have like two books. I really do.
Yeah.
And I've got, I have chapters blocked out and I have all kinds of stuff written. It's a matter of paring it down in a lot of ways.
Of course.
Like, what am I going to choose from? And, you know, I have certain chapters that I have, you know, like the children of Rush Street, you know, the interviews with all kinds of people who grew up on the street and whose parents were like bartenders or club owners or, you know, stuff like that.
What do you think, David, in all of your research, and again, all of you people can go to rushstreetreunion.com to be part of next Sunday. It's going to be from 2 to about 7 at Shenanigans, 16 West Division Street. It's going to be a gathering of people who have memories of Rush Street, but also people who just have fond recollections of Rush Street. What do you, as an expert now, David Fletcher, what do you hazard to say was the golden age of Rush Street?
Well,
it's a tough one.
That's really
a tough one.
Well, you know, the thing is, I've found so much interesting things in some areas of that I wish I had more on, like the 1930s and 40s. I have some fantastic photographs and some fantastic recollections of things that I found, but I haven't been able to really interview anybody from the colonial, you know, the colonial club or the colony club rather. Sonny Goldstone's yacht club was right on Oak Street. And some of these places were the Minuet Club. These places were extraordinary, but I don't have a whole lot of, you know, I'd like to get more information on those things. But the lion's share of things that I have found and during the period of time when I first became aware of that area was the late 1950s and early 1960s.
Yeah.
That to me is pretty much the golden age of the Rush Street area. And it was just so, it was hopping.
Oh,
yeah, there's so many things going on the periphery, like the Playboy exploding, and you know, all of this great music still going on in the early 60s, you still had a lot of great jazz, and
you also know, and I know you know, and David Marienthal is going to be part of the festivities at the Rush Street reunion next Sunday from 2 to 7 p.m. David, the son and nephew of George and Oscar Marienthal, who ran two prominent, relatively prominent places on Rush Street, one called the Happy Medium and the other called Mr. Kelly's. Those two places really gave it sizzle in the 60s and 70s, didn't they, David?
Indeed.
Yeah.
And indeed they did. And I have actually a really interesting connection that I have with the Marienthals going all the way back to when I was like 7 years old.
Wow, what is it?
Well, it's in the beginning of the book, and it's a thing where I was going to school at Francis Parker, and we were all standing out, the kids and I. It was springtime, and there was the soccer field was wet, and we couldn't play, so we were standing around talking. As kids do, well, what does your dad do? Oh, my dad does this. What does your dad do? And I told him what my dad does. He was an artist and a portrait artist and stuff like that. And I thought that was pretty cool. But then this one kid says, well, my dad owns a nightclub. No one's a nightclub. That's the coolest thing I've ever heard in my life. What nightclub does your dad own? And he said, he owns Mr. Kelly's. And so, you know, that to me, like, really not sparked an interest. I already had an interest in that thing. And but you know, because our school bus used to go down the street, and I'd see the lights from, you know, the Singapore, and lights from Mr. Kelly's, and see who was on the marquee and all those things. So that, to me, every time I went by Mr. Kelly's after that, I'd look to see who was on the marquee, and I think that kid's dad owns that place, you know. So there's a little bit of a of a connection going all the way back to my childhood with America.
That's really amazing. That's really
amazing.
Yeah,
now here we are working on, you know, similar projects at the same time. So it's nice.
I think that's wonderful. And the projects complement each other, too, I think. I mean, I think David is more interested in a kind of documentary, and it would be a great companion piece for your book, which is which is going to be the definitive, I think, when you finish it, the definitive history of that street. It was ever called, or in its heyday, it was called the Street of Dreams. Do you think it's still David Floodstrand, and we're talking about Rush Street, has that aura, or has that sort of dissipated? You know, because
there is some of that, though. When you can go out and sit out on the patio at Tavern on Rush, or across the street at Gibson's, some of these places, it's like, you know, you used to be able to go sit down out in front of Melvin's.
Right.
And it's long gone. Still some of that, you know.
Yeah.
Melvin's was fantastic. You spend an afternoon out there with a pitcher of margaritas and, you know,
realize that Melvin's was one of, now every place in the world has an outdoor joint, and Melvin's was one of the very first.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary place. Yeah.
Jack Binion. David Floodstrand is the impresario behind next Sunday's Rush Street Reunion. It's the third, being held at Shenanigans at 16 West Division from 2 to 7. It'll have all manner of food and some DJs and people, music of the time, and memories of the time. David is working on a book. David Marienthal will also be there talking about his documentary in the works. David Floodstrand, you know how much I admire you for doing this, because it's about Chicago history and an important aspect of Chicago history. So I hope you're jammed next week, next Sunday.
I hope so. Yeah. Let me just interject that we have Denise Tomasello, Chicago's queen of cabaret.
Gave her first review. I did. Yep. I love Denise. Okay. Love Denise.
And we have Tony Ocean. Our two headliners, and we're going to have some other people and a bunch of DJs, like you said, and from who played down in the area, you know, back in the day, like Tim Borden and myself and a couple of other guys. So it's a party. An eclectic experience.
And proceeds, part of the proceeds will benefit the Lupus Foundation of America, and that's a good thing. Go to RushStreetReunion.com. David, I hope you get to just sit around and listen and have fun instead of, like, you know, schlepping around. I hope this one, the third one's the charm for you, David. Thanks a million for coming on.
My pleasure.